Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, a weekly program about working people, the labor movement, and organizing on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Don McIntosh.
And I'm Maribeth Healy. Tonight's show is a three-parter. In our first segment, we'll talk with Nancy McLean, author of Freedom Is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. Her book is about how affirmative action and the civil rights movement have transformed the American workplace culture in the last half century. Next, then we'll get an update on new free trade agreements the U.S. has negotiated with Colombia, Peru, and the Persian Gulf monarchy, Oman. For that segment, we'll be joined by Michael Gagan of the Oregon Free Trade Coalition. And in the final portion of the hour, we'll review the stragglers, healthcare-related ballot measure reforms that are staggering towards the finish line, the July 7th signature deadline that will determine which initiatives make it on the ballot this November.
Now we'd like to welcome Nancy McLean, who joins us by phone from her home in Chicago. Nancy McLean is a professor of history and African-American studies at Northwestern University and author of the just-released book, Freedom Is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. Nancy McLean, welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you for having me, Don.
Thanks for joining us. I guess, you know, for those readers probably who have not had a chance to read the book and who are hearing about it for the first time, what is the title come from, Freedom Is Not Enough? That's a reference to a speech by LBJ?
Yeah, it's a speech that LBJ made at Howard University in 1965. It was a commencement address. And I chose it as the title for the book, first because he was really in that speech channeling the thinking that was coming out of the Black Freedom Movement, and the arguments about why freedom is not enough. So it's important in that way. But also I think it's important in today's context because we've had this kind of conservative takeover of the language of civil rights, you know, very disingenuous takeover to say that all we need is colorblindness and anti-discrimination laws and everything will be fine. And I think, you know, that phrase, freedom is not enough, really captures the way that much more is needed to create genuine equality in this country.
You know, which I think, you know, we'll get to in just a moment, some of the strategies for getting beyond just, you know, simple freedom or colorblindness, but trying to look at results as well. But, you know, I wondered if you could give our listeners a sense of what things were like 50 years ago, in 1956, you know, for African Americans in particular, but also for women, for Mexican Americans. I mean, there was you know, in many cases, a century of legal, social, cultural barriers to them taking all kinds of jobs.
Absolutely, and I'm glad that you asked that because I think we really need to have that sense of a starting point to see where we are today. So the first chapter in the book is actually about the situation in the mid-1950s, and I call it the rightness of whiteness, which was a phrase used by one later commentator, but it really captured the way there was just an entire culture of exclusion that just took for granted that the best jobs at all levels, from, you know, skilled blue-collar work through managerial and professional work, would be held by white men. And so African Americans were confined almost overwhelmingly to menial jobs. Women were shunted into certain jobs. Mexican Americans could only get different kinds of menial jobs. And it wasn't just that there were these barriers, but there was actually a culture that sustained that and that rationalized these exclusions such that many people just took it to be common sense. And of course, it was perfectly legal in the 50s to discriminate. There was no federal law against employment discrimination, and that was seen as just one of the prerogatives that businesses had, was to, you know, choose whomever they wanted for, you know, whatever reason they chose, and they chose not to hire blacks, women, and Mexican Americans for better jobs at any level.
You know, and, you know, judging from our present day perspective, I mean, we look at that and say, well, that's unacceptable. But I mean, they did have justifications at the time. I mean, they didn't go around thinking, you know, what rotten things they could do to other people. How did they justify it in their minds, this kind of a systematic discrimination?
Well, the main kind of defense of it certainly was employers' prerogatives, and that, you know, so that's a place where these movements for other kinds of equality really converged with the labor movement in challenging these managerial prerogatives and saying, you know, no, these are businesses with a public impact, and therefore they need to be subject to democratic control. So that was one part of it, that employers understood themselves as just having the freedom to do this.
Right, like government couldn't come in and say, well, you know, who you could or couldn't hire.
Exactly.
You had the right to hire someone or associate with someone, that kind of thing.
Right. And then, you know, they were imbibing the culture of the 1950s in which, you know, sort of white supremacy was kind of taken for granted and, you know, not necessarily the kind of overt, aggressive, violent behavior that you'd see in the South in these years, but still just a kind of tacit assumption that, of course, white people were the only people who could do certain jobs and, you know, black people just didn't have the skills and, you know, you wouldn't even think of placing an ad in a black newspaper or, you know, alerting someone in a black community institution to the fact that a job was coming open because you just assumed that they couldn't do it. So you know, much of it was really that kind of insidious, taken for granted kind of tacit assumptions about who could do what and why.
And your book, I think you kind of give a real, a well-developed sense that, you know, the very idea of citizenship was kind of confined to white people in general, and particularly the idea of a white male was being the sort of the core citizen. Oh, sure, you had some other groups, but really when you thought of an American, it was a white male.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, looking at jobs is a really good kind of litmus test for who's included. And so, yeah, one of the things I talk about is the pivotal role that jobs play, or access to different kinds of jobs plays, in deciding belonging in our society, you know, because our society is so fundamentally premised on work and on, you know, sort of the idea of things like the American dream as a kind of social contract.
Right, one of the first questions you ask when you meet someone is, you know, what do you do? So
exactly.
We're defining ourselves by what we spend, you know, maybe 40 hours plus a week.
And that's actually quite strange to people from some other countries and cultures who come here and they're kind of shocked. You know, they sort of think it's rude that Americans say, what do you do, when they meet someone. But that shows you, I think, how central work is to everything in our culture, you know, to sort of understanding if we belong, you know, in the larger polity, you know, where we stand, how we connect to each other. So these issues about jobs really, really cut to the heart of citizenship and of equality and power in American society.
So, you know, of course, was it 1955, Brown versus Board of Education, and there were a series of other sort of court decisions that were changing the way the government treated different categories of citizens, saying basically couldn't discriminate on the basis of race, desegregation of the army, that kind of thing. But from the standpoint of the workplace, where, you know, most Americans spend most of their lives and define themselves, you know, it was the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that's really the profound, transformative, radical act, that you spend most of your time, most of the time in your book, detailing how that came about and the impacts it had.
Yeah, I really see the book in a lot of ways as a kind of a social history of the Civil Rights Act, in the sense that it looks at why the Civil Rights Act was such a huge priority for the Black Freedom Movement. And in fact, you know, most Americans today don't know it, but this demand for an end to employment discrimination was really a driving force, part of the Civil Rights Movement from the 1940s on. Getting a Fair Employment Practices Commission was the top priority for the NAACP from the 40s into the 1960s. There were 200 earlier tries before the Civil Rights Act passed. It only passed after a 534-hour filibuster. I mean, it was really a fight to get this. And once it was won, it just became this incredible resource for workers who had grievances and who had not had any way to address them before. And, you know, of course there were limitations to the act, and I don't mean to make it sound like, you know, suddenly it was nirvana and things were great and everything was settled, but if you look at it, you know, from a historical perspective, which of course I do as a historian, it really was a monumental change, and suddenly workers had, you know, in effect a kind of battering ram to beat down these doors that had been locked against them for so long. And so it was just incredibly galvanizing at the grassroots, and thousands, you know, even in the first year alone, about 9,000 workers filed complaints with the EEOC, and thereafter the numbers just skyrocketed. So individuals were filing complaints, there were class action complaints of discrimination, there were workers' caucuses, you know, in various jobs and industries and unions that were, you know, whether black workers' caucuses or women workers' caucuses or things like that. You know, various kinds of community struggles to open up, the building trades and the construction industry to black workers. So there's just a really sweeping surge of organizing going on around equal employment that we really haven't looked at before and really seen as being as central to all of these movements for equality as, in fact, these struggles were.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to Labor Radio. We're talking with Nancy McLean, author of Freedom Is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. You know, in your book, you know, you write that, you know, the African American civil rights movement is really the sort of the engine that got that act passed, and it's, you know, sort of the most obvious beneficiary when you think about it. And yet there were, you know, whole other groups of people, particularly the majority of the country's citizens, women, but also Mexican Americans and other groups that were able to use the Civil Rights Act of 1964 actually to kind of get their movements going and to fight workplace discrimination in ways that they hadn't really, you know, been counting on before that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think, you know, most people who are, you know, familiar with this history at all do think of the African-American civil rights movement as having created a kind of model that inspired other groups and that, you know, kicked off so much in the 60s. But what I found in the book is it isn't just the example of the civil rights movement that inspired these other struggles, but it is the fact that this movement won this practical victory in the Civil Rights Act and Title VII, the employment title of that act, which really invited other groups to rethink their strategies for seeking equality. And so it had a very dramatic effect on Mexican-American civil rights organizing, really changed the nature of their strategy for seeking equality quite dramatically. And similarly, it really changed the women's movement and changed the relationship of the feminist movement to the trade union movement, to the other civil rights movements of the time. So this victory, this legal victory, ended up really changing the society and culture in the ways that activists, you know, took it and used it and put it to work in ways that I think really have not been adequately recognized and that are also actually really, I think, sort of inspiring and helpful to know about today at a time when, you know, I think many people feel understandable discouragement about the state of American politics and, you know, sort of where we are and where things are going.
Yeah, Nancy, you raised a very good point, because that's exactly, excuse me, what I was thinking about, is that, you know, there's very many similarities, and I'm really interested in what you found doing your research around the civil rights movement and the impact on organized labor, and how did that struggle make labor stronger, I would hope, but I don't know what you discovered in your research there.
Yeah, well, there's one of the things I really emphasize in the book is that there is, you know, a very powerful synergy between the labor movement and the black freedom movement. And, you know, if you think about it and you actually look at it practically, the civil rights movement was unthinkable without the New Deal state, you know, the sort of changes that labor organizing and other kinds of organizing forced in government in the 1930s, because that really created, you know, sort of a framework for the idea that government would ever do anything about any of these kinds of issues. So the New Deal was foundational to the civil rights movement in that way, and also the CIO was an incredible force for organizing at the grassroots, for paying attention to class issues, for raising issues of discrimination, etc. Now, that movement wasn't perfect, and certainly the AFL craft unions were very committed to an exclusive model. You know, many of them had racial exclusion built into their very constitution. So the relationship with labor was often a troubled relationship, but a really, really important one. And, I mean, I think it is important for people to realize that today the labor movement is the most integrated social institution in America. You know, so anybody who's interested in racial justice who turns their back on the labor movement, I think, is making a really big mistake. And when we look at this history, you know, you see both sides. I mean, you see the ways in which the labor movement was an incredible resource and provided real tools for black workers in the sense of contracts that could have anti-discrimination clauses, grievance procedures, the ability to strike over grievances, including racial discrimination. So all of that's there. And then there was also, you know, a lot of racial inequality in workplaces that unions tacitly defended when they had separate, you know, seniority lines and whatnot, and that, you know, union leaderships were often, you know, resistant to demands for equality from the rank and file. So it's a complicated relationship, but a really significant one. And I think that the unions today that are making the most progress are the ones that were transformed by these Title VII struggles and really welcomed in black workers and women more recently immigrants. So unions like AFSCME, Unite Here, SEIU, those unions were really changed by the kind of struggles I describe in the book.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because I think those same unions that are working to organize immigrant workers today are seeing more growth, because I feel that workers, especially those on the lower socioeconomic level, really see the power of labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they see it in the same context as the civil rights movement, but they're very similar, and the goals of both of those movements are so similar. It's important, I think, that we continue to join forces, because some of the things that you talk about, I was just, you know, kind of closing my eyes when you were talking about 1956, and here we are in 2006. And while, yes, an amazing amount of things have changed, unfortunately, sometimes I think it feels like the more things change, the more things stay the same. So what can we learn to move forward?
Part of the difficulty is that activists are always aiming at a kind of a moving target, and so these struggles for equality in the 50s and 60s and 70s were sort of taking off at a time when the labor market was fundamentally changing in this country, you know, when economic restructuring was beginning, what they then called automation, all of the processes that have eliminated the jobs that were the good jobs of the 50s and 60s, the good blue-collar job, you know, I mean, they were hard jobs to do and they weren't pleasant, but, you know, people could make a decent income, could send their kids to college, get a house, have a pension, have health care, you know, and as we know, and I'm sure you talk about a lot on the show, the jobs that are being created now in large numbers are service industry jobs, you know, that don't have the benefits, that don't have, the job security, that don't, you know, that don't enable people to provide for themselves and their families.
And live that American dream, right?
Exactly. And so there's a lot of tragedy in the story that I tell in the book, because, you know, there was significant change made for a time in industries like steel and auto and rubber and meatpacking and all of those, you know, blue-collar jobs. Affirmative action struggles by the workers in those industries really yielded some significant changes, but of course the jobs in those industries have been disappearing, and so, you know, it's kind of like the labor of Sisyphus. You know, you sort of push the boulder up a hill and it starts to fall down, and you got to push it up again and, you know, figure out new terrain to do this on. But I think the fact that people were able to do it so effectively and with such impact in these earlier years should be encouraging to us today. And I think it is also interesting to note that today both the AFL-CIO and the Change to Win Coalition are really using the language of the civil rights movement to gain traction for the struggles that they're waging today. So you saw, for example, a few years ago, the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, which mm-hmm. was very self-consciously modeled on the, you know, Black Civil Rights Freedom Rides. The AFL-CIO is talking about, you know, workers' rights as human rights. And so I think, you know, people are really today seeing the kinship between these movements in a way that just wasn't true, you know, even 15 years ago.
Once again, you're listening to Labor Radio, a weekly program about working people and the labor movement on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also 91.9 in Hood River and 100.7 in the Willamette Valley, and streaming online at kboo.fm. I'm your host, Don McIntosh. I'm with co-host Mary Beth Healy, and we're talking with Nancy McLean, author of the recently released book by Harvard University Press, Freedom is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. I thought you did a very interesting, a very fair look at, as we're talking about, the labor movement and it not being a monolith, but being split. You had some more progressive sort of CIO-style unions like Walter Reuther's United Auto Workers that were kind of in the right up there along the in the front lines with leaders like Martin Luther King. I mean, you had others, the AFL craft unions, that it took a while to bring them along. In fact, it took some government action. For example, things like, this sort of hereditary handing down of jobs from father to son, or the control over who would be allowed to be in the union apprenticeship programs, who would be allowed to go out and get jobs at the hiring hall. A lot of that, they had, you know, rules that seemed colorblind. You had to be recommended by three members. But if you think about all the members being white men, then that could be a real bar, a barrier. Those have been replaced by and large now, such that, any kinds of qualifications unions use in the building trades have to be, have imposed no barrier, of those kinds. And I think you did a good job of looking at that, the less pleasant aspects too. I remember one case in which there was a hate strike, a strike by a group of workers basically opposing the entry of African Americans into the ranks.
Yeah, it's a complex story, and it's got a lot of sad and a lot of ugly chapters. But I also really did try to write with empathy, you know, and to try to understand the perspectives of, you know, people on various sides of these issues. Because, you know, a lot of those white workers, I mean, some of them were blatantly racist, you know, and aggressively so, but some of them were also, you know, workers who were really concerned about maintaining the bit of kind of economic security they'd gotten. You know, they were in industries that are very vulnerable to layoffs, that are, you know, in jobs that are extremely dangerous, where you want to trust a partner. So this is complicated stuff, and, you know, so I really tried not to create a, you know, kind of simplistic kind of good guy, bad guy kind of thing, but really look at the full history and also, you know, sometimes give credit where credit is due. One of the things that's interesting, even in the building trades that were the most resistant to equality, is that in the 1980s, when women began to enter the industry, in, you know, of course, I'm sure most people would imagine that the levels of harassment, including some pretty vicious sexual harassment, tradeswomen got. But nearly all of the women who, at least those who remained in the industry, said that they always had at least one ally, one male ally, you know, or a couple, you know. And so there were always a couple of guys who, you know, they might not have been the best friends of the women or whatever, but they saw that they were working hard and they're trying to do their jobs, and they really helped them to survive. And a lot of the women credit those guys for having really made a difference. So that's one of the things that I tried to do in writing the book too, is really think about it, about these issues in a kind of strategic way, in an organizing way, and think about people who are interested in social change and what they need to know about these histories. And one of the things I think people do need to know is at that micro level how you know, in this case, these women were able to develop and cultivate allies among these men such that they were able to stay in the industry and in some cases make really significant changes. For example, in Madison, Wisconsin, now women are 25% of the firefighting force. You know, that's something that would have been unthinkable in the 1950s or even in the 1960s.
You know, I wonder, before I want to turn the subject a little bit to the politics, but if we could, actually, this is might be helpful. Could you give us an understanding of what specifically the Civil Rights Act said and did? And you know, we see it as sort of vaguely associated with affirmative action, but that sort of came later as an application, right?
Yeah, well, the Civil Rights Act, you know, it has many different titles that apply to different issues, including schooling and public accommodations, but the one that I most focus on is Title VII, which is the employment title, which outlaws discrimination in employment by race, sex, nationality, and religion, and also then provided mechanisms like the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the right to sue, et cetera, you know, various means by which that new right to be free of discrimination could be activated. It didn't specifically mention affirmative action, but actually affirmative action as a phrase had been used the year before in a federal contracting order that John F. Kennedy issued. And then that contracting, federal contracting, actually was the place where affirmative action came into being most powerfully in these years, in part because government contracts were funding so much construction in American cities in the 1960s and in black communities. And you have to remember, you know, sort of the how much organizing was going on in black urban communities in these years. People really pressing to open up these jobs to black workers and saying their jobs, their tax dollars shouldn't be subsidizing discrimination against them in their own communities. And so that really put pressure on the government to adopt affirmative action, which they did first and most dramatically in the construction industry in the Philadelphia plan in 1969.
And then there specifically, that's looking at maybe like recruiting in you know, African American communities,
for the trades,
and also maybe giving some kind of preferential hiring or getting rid of unnecessary tests and qualifications.
Yeah, and the affirmative action programs, you know, I think because there's been such a concerted conservative attack on affirmative action policies over, you know, the years since then, many people have a distorted idea of what affirmative action is, and they think it's what conservatives say it is, which is quotas to put people who are not competent into jobs, and that is not true. All of these policies. Well, first of all, their main goal was to overcome, in some cases, you know, literally generations of exclusion and find ways to welcome people into jobs and enable them to do what they had the aptitude to do. So sometimes workers might have like the same training or the same educational background or what have you. So in that case, you might have a training program. You might do outreach in a black community or to a women's school or, you know, that kind of thing. But also, where the kind of rubber hit the road with affirmative action was in the institution of goals for when the hiring would happen and timetables for seeing whether it did happen, and that came into being with the Philadelphia plan, and that was what drove conservatives around the bend, and, you know, that they started to call quotas. But really, that was a standard business practice, you know, what businesses call management by objective, which is that you set a target and then you decide the date by which you're going to see if you made the target, and if you don't make it, you're going to see why not. So that, you know, affirmative action was essentially adopting that framework, saying, you know, look, we can't just say we want to be better. We want to see how better we can be given the potential workforce we have, and if we don't do it, see why we don't do it. But, you know, but there was no insistence that, you know, a certain number of people had to be hired or else. What was required was a good faith effort to make that happen.
I think the Philadelphia plan might be a good jumping off point to talk about the politics of this, because if I remember your book correctly, the Philadelphia plan was actually proposed by the Nixon administration, seemingly in a way to sort of maybe recruit, get some African-American support for the Republican Party. You know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 actually it specifically forbid quotas per se, but that you could have a target or a range that you were shooting for, which is what the plan did. But that came under such attack, and it looked like maybe a new strategy was in the birthing, which was probably previewed by what everyone says now was the most significant election maybe in the last couple of generations, 1964. Even though LBJ won in a landslide, the Barry Goldwater, that conservative radical at the time, his policies ended up becoming sort of the founding principles of the Republican conservative resurgence, and a lot of that was around race. Can you talk about how that played out?
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm glad that you raised that because it's really important. One of the things I do with this book is, alongside telling the stories of the black movement and the women's movement and the Mexican-American movement, tell the story of their opposition. And in particular, I mean, I did research in business archives and, you know, National Association of Manufacturers, Chamber of Commerce, you know, see what all those folks were up to. But ultimately, the really pivotal source of opposition was the conservative movement that was built by William F. Buckley and others when they founded National Review in 1955, and that later brought us Goldwater's candidacy, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush. And their opposition was really fierce and was ultimately, to my mind, the really decisive force, because you see over the years business coming around, you know, at least sections of business coming around and saying, golly, you know, maybe diversity can be in our interest. You know, there's a way that we can use this to get to new markets or whatever. You see the military making really significant changes, you know, and desegregating and actively integrating its officer corps in these years. So some very conservative institutions came around, but this right-wing movement, which became the core of the new Republican Party that's now in power, they never came around, and they fought every one of these things fiercely. And I have to say, you know, it's not easy to shock me. I'm not naive and I'm not new to all of this, but what I found in the archives, in the papers of people like William F. Buckley and James Jackson Kilpatrick, another conservative leader, and in their publications from the 1950s and 60s and 70s really, really shocked me for how vehement their opposition was to just any single measure that would have promoted equality and inclusion, whether it was Brown versus Board of Education, desegregating schools, whether it was voting rights in the late 50s, whether it was the Civil Rights Act, you know, on all of these things, they were this sort of united phalanx, and they were dead set opposed to change, and sometimes quite belligerently racist until they kind of remodeled themselves in the 1970s.
And they did. I think they very deftly repositioned themselves rhetorically on the race issue, and yet it was sort of understood, I think, that between the two parties, the Republican Party was going to become the one that was opposed to something like quotas. It was going to defend maybe, for example, white workers from maybe the demands of black workers, for example, that would cause them to lose their jobs. And because because of that, I think it really engineered the shift that took place in the South, where, you know, had the South solidly Democratic and turning in the course of, you know, less than 20 years to a, pretty much a bastion of Republicanism that it is to this day. And then ironically, you have really the latter-day Republicans adopting full-scale the rhetoric of the civil rights movement, populating cabinets with African-Americans and other minorities, really out in front rhetorically, but very much the limit of their activism is colorblindness. And all the programs that you could think of, it seems to me, that would actually empower African-Americans and other minority groups economically, really being destroyed by that movement.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually show the process in the book and kind of tell the story from the inside in the 1970s using these conservative archival collections and whatnot. And it really is, I think, best described as a kind of political jujitsu in the sense that the conservatives were really floundering at the beginning of the 1970s. They, you know, they had lost support. You know, they were kind of, you know, laughing stock in many quarters. They were not doing well. And what they did in the course of remodeling, with a lot of help from neoconservatives who were a new part of the movement, is refashion themselves for a post-civil rights era. And so, and the reason I call it jujitsu is, you know, of course, traditional jujitsu as martial arts, you use the power of your opponent against them, and that's exactly what conservatives began to do, is take the moral power of the language of civil rights and use it against everything that the civil rights movement stood for. And it's really fascinating to watch because, you know, I think people probably forget, but that, you know, at the end of the 1960s and the beginning of the 1970s, I mean, there were liberal Republicans, right?
That's
and there
right.
were black Republicans who were very pro-racial equality. You know, there was a black head of the EEOC who was really, you know, aggressively trying to really change things. And those people were all replaced. And so, you know, with people like Clarence Thomas. And so you see this weird juxtaposition where at the same time as they're kind of stealing the language of civil rights, they're actually turning the Republican Party against things that it had stood for years, including things like the Equal Rights Amendment. So at the very moment they're using this language in policy terms and in practical terms, they're becoming much more hostile to inclusion and to equality than even the Republican Party had been before.
And you have some terrific analysis of that in the book. You know, we've just got maybe a minute or two left. I wanted to, Mary Beth may have a closing question. I have one of my own, which is probably the difficult question for a historian. I want to ask about the future here. But I wanted to quote from your book, actually, which is something I was struck by. You say at one point, this describing the spirit of the times back around the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the demand for economic inclusion fit the prevailing ethos in a way that is hard to document. It bespoke a public optimism difficult to recapture in our more skeptical, pessimistic era. Its hopefulness about the prospects for African-American mobility and the future of interracial relations grew from widespread confidence in the capacity of government to promote the common good. And I just think that, you know, I was born in 1970, so I'm sort of have had this experience of really the times being defined in conservative sense and an economic anxiety and declining ambitions for the progressives and the left. And I wonder, you know, as a historian, do you see, you know, signs that this project, for example, racial equality, might get back on the tracks?
Yes, I definitely think it might get back on the tracks. And I think it, often when it does, it will get back on the tracks in a kind of different way than, you know, than it was before. In other words, it will look different because the country has changed so much and the culture and in the context. And one of the reasons I went all the way back to 1950, is because that was a moment when the Black Freedom Movement had to redefine itself, you know, in the wake of the Cold War, McCarthyism, you know, kind of the ravages of the Red Scare on both the labor movement and the civil rights movement coming out of the 40s. And they really had to kind of take stock and say, hey, you know, how do we go forward in this daunting new context? And they found a way to do it. And so I believe that we're in a similar time now where there has been really significant social change, you know, a lot of political challenges, a lot of things that have have made it difficult to continue to make headway in the old way. At the same time, if we think about it, there are tremendous resources, I think, for achieving the promise of these struggles from these earlier years, not least of which is the transformation in American culture that the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and now, you know, even the lesbian and gay movement, immigrant rights, disability rights. I mean, we have a culture that is much more alert to differences and much more committed to equality than ever before in American history, and that is no small victory. But where the real challenge is, I think, is in the way that the economy is currently set up and in the non-responsiveness of our political system to what people at the grassroots really want. So to my mind, the challenge for people who are interested in change is really to go back and to learn from the past in order to get a better compass to figure out how we can go forward in this context. So, you know, I recognize that it's challenging and it's hard, but I also am confident that there are possibilities there and that really skilled organizers who know their history and who hone their craft can do good work.
Nancy McLean, it's been a pleasure to have you on Labor Radio this evening.
Thank you for having me, Don. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining us. We've been talking with Nancy McLean, author of Freedom Is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace, a very readable account of the history of the civil rights movement and the impact it's had on lots of movements.
You're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Yeah, that was a fascinating conversation. We could have had it for four shows, I think. And we'd like to thank some of our sponsors for bringing that intelligent conversation to you.
KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future.
In addition to SEIU, Local 503, OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
I wanted to add, actually, if you want information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number to call is 503-251-2344. Now we turn to our in-studio guest, who's been waiting patiently through that discussion, and we're going to be turning to talk now about free trade agreements. Michael Gagan joins us from the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition, and good to have you back on the program. Free trade agreements. We'll get into how free these free trade agreements are, but most people are sort of familiar with this idea of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, maybe the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, and there seems to be a proliferation of those. A handful have been passed in the last few years. Now there's a few more in the hopper, including one with a monarchy, a sultanate in the Persian Gulf.
In the Persian Gulf, the Oman Free Trade Agreement. But I've been sitting here listening to the interview that you just had and thinking about how fascinating it is to hear about some of that history. With the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition, we look at what's happening right now around jobs, particularly in the state of Oregon, where the challenge is still, to a certain extent, getting integration and getting into jobs. But the challenge is also holding on to jobs, and it's not that we're losing so much to automation. These days, it's about outsourcing. It's about international competition, a restructuring of production that's costing a lot of our best-paid manufacturing jobs. We're watching them slip away. So that's something that brought me into this whole thing around free trade. And once you start poking around in free trade, you start seeing it's a bigger and bigger picture, but one that's actually really important to start talking about, especially right now.
In her book, not to take it back to that necessarily, but there's a very extensive part of a chapter about the struggle to get jobs for African Americans in North Carolina in the textile and apparel industries there, and it took a long time, but they made real progress and had good paying jobs. And then guess what? All those jobs, as far as I understand, have been shipped to low wage havens, though not all very few of which we have free trade agreements. But it's seen as part of the movement. Free trade agreements sort of paving the way to further foreign investments, protecting investors overseas. What does the U.S.-Oman Free Trade Agreement sort of specialize in?
Yeah, totally. Have you been all following the peace in the Middle East talk that they're talking about, how to withdraw from the Middle East and the whole situation there with Iraq and Afghanistan? Has been in the news a lot. This whole trade agreement with Oman, which is a nation in the Middle East that borders Saudi Arabia, I call it the Peace of the Middle East plan, because it's the thing that's not being spoken about right now with our whole foreign policy. the Bush administration is pursuing this whole thing about how, you know, basically we've decimated two countries with bombing. We've lost over 2,000 of our troops have been sacrificed in this whole war effort. And the plan beyond war and just violence is to establish peace through trade. It's countering terrorism through trade. And when you really start looking at how at this stuff, how it's structured, it just starts to sound more and more ridiculous that after they're done with the military operation in the Middle East, the goal is to set up a whole Mideast trade pact that would take in a lot of the countries that we're occupying now or, you know, witnessing the social unrest in. And the Amman Free Trade Agreement is a piece of this, where we've picked out this one country there that we're signing a trade agreement with, and it's based on the whole NAFTA model, right? This is the idea of how do you open up the borders to make it that much easier for corporations to relocate their, you know, production of sewing and sweatshops or small plastic trinkets that get sold at Target and Walmart in countries that don't have labor and environmental standards.
Is that what it's about in the case of Oman? There's only 2.5 million people there.
It's a country the size of Kansas. What's I started to get more and more outraged about this the more I learned about Oman. It was a process for me of finding it on a map and starting to learn some of the history there. This is a constitutional monarchy that actually forbids independent unions from forming bargaining terms of work, workplace conditions, pay and benefits. They're forbidden. And that's not something that took place in like 1965 or 1975. This is something that happened 3 years ago by official decree of the monarch of Oman. And this is a country that we've now gone out of our way to negotiate a free trade agreement with on this premise that, you know, this is going to bring prosperity, it's going to bring wealth, but we're not willing to guarantee.
Michael, is the question.
Well, I think it has probably quite a bit to do with Bush and his family interests. 90% of the exports of Oman currently are crude oil. You know, I want to be fair, too. You mentioned constitutional monarch. As I understand it, the Constitution was written by the monarch. But and they have an elected advisory council, which for the first time they had elections, like last year, I think it was.
There's another important piece to this, too, in looking at who lives in Oman and who works in Oman. This is a country that 30% of the workforce or more is actually guest workers who are brought in to do menial work that people there don't necessarily want to do, or is so underpaid and undervalued that people aren't lining up for the jobs. And they're flying people in from countries like Pakistan and the Philippines, whose, you know, their status in Oman is dependent on their employer and on the government. So you can see that's a whole population that's especially vulnerable to exploitation. And into this social situation, we're going to drop this free trade agreement that just encourages the whole sweatshop export model for how you're supposed to develop. But you've got this really vulnerable set of workers there, and we're doing nothing through our free trade agreement to bolster them or give them a leg up or figure out, you know, if they were to organize, what resources or recourse or backbone would they be getting from a trade agreement? It's completely been absent. So it's really shocking that this whole thing is based on peace and prosperity, but we're doing something, you know, look what happened with NAFTA. We're actually sending our National Guard to patrol the border. That's not a model of, you know, prosperity and progress. So I'm very apprehensive about this, and it's very timely we're talking about this because actually coming up in Congress right now.
The Senate Finance Committee has got to vote on it?
Yeah, the Senate Finance Committee is...
Which happens to include Gordon Smith and Ron Wyden, a rare Oregon kind of...
Coup.
I don't know. It has extra influence as a state for some peculiar reason on that particular committee, which has to approve free trade agreements before they go to the full Senate for a vote.
Yeah, so it happens that both senators from Oregon sit on this, I think it's a 21-person committee, that all trade agreements go through before they get to be voted on. Now,
how do you think they're likely to vote?
That's a good question. They've already looked at it once. There's sort of this song and dance process around these trade agreements because we're not allowed in Congress to amend or change a negotiated trade agreement. That's called fast track.
Which they approve. They put those blinders, those shackles on themselves. But
exactly. To expedite the process.
I think it's actually not called fast track. It's called, Trade Promotion Authority now?
Yeah, for the real, yeah. Yeah, but it's the same premise.
I think that's because activists were successful in actually defining fast track for the American public. They realized they didn't know quite what it was, but it was a bad thing. It had something to do with these NAFTA-style trade agreements, which, quite frankly, are very unpopular here amongst the average citizen.
For sure. A lot of people recognize the word NAFTA. They recognize fast track. the actual processes that these go through are very complicated. I have to relearn them constantly. So it's made to be very difficult to access for your regular person to, like, crack open a trade agreement and read.
I didn't think that this kind of thing would happen in the Middle East, something like, export assembly. And yet that's exactly what happened in the country of Jordan, which we already have a U.S.-Jordan free trade agreement with, signed a few years ago, actually, by the Clinton administration. I didn't predict that this would happen, but now apparently they have a bit of an apparel industry. And if you're one of those who pays attention to the clothes you get at the Gap or Meyer and Frank or wherever you shop for your duds, you'll see the label Made in Jordan now. And interestingly enough, by and large, it's not made by Jordanians, but it's made in Jordan. It's made by Bangladeshi guest workers in Jordan and so forth. So I don't know if that's what's going to happen in Oman with this free trade agreement, but I would be less skeptical now than I would have been a few years ago.
I'll tell you two quick stories that go along with this. Yeah, the Jordan trade agreement, if you want to look into the future, you look into the past. Not so long ago, they passed this Jordan trade agreement. In May, the New York Times has a whole expose on the ugly side of free trade in, of all places, Jordan, where they're creating these sweatshops with terrible labor conditions that are supplying Target, Walmart, and JCPenney in this country. So that whole model of, where can you go? What's the next country we can go to where we can get real cheap labor to make our stuff? That whole race to the bottom, right? Is something we could be avoiding if we were negotiating trade policy that actually set those floors. We could be active. We could be creative about it. We could give people hope in those countries that things can be different and better. But that would take some real initiative on the part of our trade negotiators who are...
I don't think that these agreements are about labor rights at all. In fact, they exclude those. But I do have to keep coming back to them. We don't have a free trade agreement with Bangladesh. We don't have one with Pakistan. And yet, there's an awful lot of textiles and apparel that's imported from those countries. So it's not always obvious. It seems to me that the free trade agreement necessarily needs to be in place for the kind of race to the bottom that you're talking about. I think. For me, it's more, an extra set of structures that investors can count on so that they can't, that the country can go one way and not another. It can privatize, but it can't unprivatize, at least not without paying foreign investors in a way that they didn't have to, where they didn't used to have to do.
Well, this stuff doesn't happen by coincidence. There is a U.S. Middle East Free Trade Coalition, which now includes 120 corporate members, including Bechtel and Halliburton. And on that list, you'll find Citigroup and ExxonMobil, these corporations that have very consciously seen this as something that can secure their interests, secure cheap labor, often at the expense of working people here, often at the expense of working people in our trade partner countries. And to give you a sense of how abysmal some of the language is, so the Senate Finance Committee goes through the song and dance process of reviewing this trade agreement that they can't actually amend. And 18 senators voted unanimously that they wanted to make sure that products made with forced labor under slave labor conditions would not be included in the Oman trade agreement. And really think about that for a second. Why did they have to pass a special amendment to do that? And why wasn't that just a baseline taken for granted thing in our trade policy just to start off with? And they're definitely not shooting high.
Already happening in Jordan.
Right.
That's what the New York Times expose found, is that you had Bangladeshi workers who were there sort of brought by recruiters and lied about the conditions and not being paid and so forth and forbidden to leave. And, it gets to begin to look like forced labor that you're talking about.
Right. And heaven forbid we actually ask for some real labor standards, where people get the self-determination to determine their conditions of work through forming an independent union.
Well, and the thing is, Don, is that this reminds me of the quote that you read out of Nancy's book, right? And that whole issue, and I think this is whether it's free trade, healthcare, the environment, workers' rights, the Supreme Court, right? This crew that's in power right now, there is not a thing that government can do well except make them money. Right. It's not a vehicle for change. It's not a vehicle to increase standards for all of us. Right. That whole lift us all up by our collective bootstrap might be a good mantra for them, but it's really discouraging, and you want to have hopefulness for people.
Not to be fair to this crew that doesn't deserve my fairness, but I mean the Bush folks. I mean I have a grievance, which is that the Clinton administration was very much in the same boat. They were this was a segment of the Democratic Party that was avidly pro free trade, and Ron Wyden is among them, and Bill Clinton and Hillary and that whole administration. I mean they fought to get NAFTA over the majority of the Democrats in Congress, and they won. And I feel like, Michael, I don't know what your analysis is, but I feel like, until the Democratic Party comes to a better, maybe more pro-worker, and not just American worker, but pro-worker around the world, position on trade policy, I think they're going to be seen as sellouts.
I think in some ways...
And it doesn't matter that only a third of them voted for it. The feeling, the memory is the betrayal by the Democrats.
Yeah. This is, in some ways, it gives me hope. Because this is not a partisan issue. Now, last year, there was a whole vote on expanding NAFTA to Central America, the CAFTA vote, which ended up being a lot of Democrats taking a stand against CAFTA, including some of our long-term trade advocates here in Oregon, like Earl Blumenauer and Darlene Hooley and David Wu. But you also had Republicans who were taking a second look at this and being like, this is not good for my constituency. And crossing over. So there's a whole room to rethink this in a really creative way. And this is an issue that I can talk to folks in conservative parts of Eastern Oregon and relate to just as well as I can talk to folks in, union manufacturing jobs, Democratic voting records here in Portland. But then you have the cases like, Ron Wyden, Senator Smith, people who feel comfortable in their office and have made they did some of their best thinking around these trade issues like 15 years ago, and they haven't been willing to reevaluate to say, wait a minute, we're losing our best-paying jobs. Is that a good thing?
But look at what these other agreements have done.
Yeah, what's the track record in Jordan, right? And how could we avoid doing that same thing in Oman? And they're a little bit banking on the idea that we're not going to pay attention to what's going on in Oman, which so it's so important to be able to talk about on this show and inform people that, look, this is not countering terror with trade. This is taking advantage of an opening to push this whole free trade agenda in a part of the world that people might not be paying attention, Oman. So I would really urge listeners now to take a minute to call your senators. They're going to vote on this possibly on Wednesday. They're banking on people not having heard it. The best thing we can do is just give them a call and say, I heard about this. I'm upset about it. I'm watching your vote, and I want you to be standing up for workers on both sides of the border.
And as far as workers' representatives, to the extent that unions are, the labor movement, they're all against the US-Oman Free Trade Agreement.
The AFL-CIO came out really strongly against the agreement, and that actually was the trigger for all kinds of other people taking a second look at this and being like, A, we have hope that we can fight it and defeat it, and B, we should really be paying attention to that part of the world where there's so much political and social instability right now that a free trade agreement thrown into the mix isn't going to help. So a number of unions took the lead, and a lot of them came and followed behind. We've done some work in Oregon talking to different locals here to sign on and make sure that they're voicing their opposition to leaders. But it's something that, constituents all over the state, regardless of your political affiliation, you take the time and you just put in a call. And I'm actually going to take a minute to give phone numbers that people can call right now.
Absolutely.
You can call Senator Ron Wyden in his D.C. office at 202-224-5244. And I'm going to give you a number for Gordon Smith. That's 202-224-3753. And it's as simple as just calling up and saying, this is my name, this is where I live, and I'm concerned about the Oman Free Trade Agreement, and I'd like you to take a stand for fair trade and vote against it.
And one thing, if I can just say, Mike, it's okay to call right now, even though it's late back east, so that when they come up or come to work in the morning, they got 75 phone calls from Oregonians saying,
absolutely,
take a look at this agreement.
And now, if you're in your car and you don't have time to write it down, or you didn't catch that number, maybe just write it right on your hand or put a rubber band on your hand or something like that to remind yourself. You can start looking it up in the phone book or online. You can get these numbers pretty easily. What's your website also, Michael?
Our website is www.citizenstrade.org. And that's a great resource for more information about the Amman Free Trade Agreement. You can get some of the information here. Just for kicks, I'm going to give that number again for anybody who has picked up the pen that didn't work or was driving.
Got halfway down through the number.
Got halfway through. Yeah, that's Ron Wyden. You can call him at 202-224-5244. And the number for Senator Gordon Smith is 202-224-3753. And I think them getting calls about this issue and people being alert to what's going on in terms of this long-term economic plan in the Middle East is just instrumental for shifting the direction of where things are rolling right now and making sure that people are accountable for their votes.
These U.S.-centered bilateral and multilateral so-called free trade agreements, I think, you know, started with Canada and then Mexico. Now we have Singapore, Australia, Morocco, Jordan, Central America, and the Dominican Republic. Oman is up next for a vote, but there's also, as I understand, Peru and and Colombia have also been negotiated and signed, but not that ratified yet.
Those are the ones that are in the pipeline. Beyond this Oman trade agreement, they're looking at a trade agreement with Peru, one with Colombia, which is one of the worst human rights violators in the Western Hemisphere. One of the questions that keeps coming up for me is, how are they choosing these countries to be our trade partners? Now, who in Oman is going to buy top-notch dried cherries from Oregon? And why are we going out of our way to choose trade partners who actually aren't brought up to a level to be able to engage as sort of equal partners in trade? You know, what would be a long-term alternative to just banging out these NAFTAs over and over with more and more countries?
I think wherever a neoliberal ideologue comes to power in another country, they're looking at maybe something like that. Or for that matter, wherever there's a go-along and get-along, once to please Uncle Sam government in power elsewhere, they're gonna be going into these trade agreements. And again, you know, free trade being maybe that you will protect monopolies over the right to reproduce Britney Spears CDs and make medicines that save your people. That kind of thing, all this freedom, you know, free trade basically being, you know, signed by monarchs to prohibit their people from doing X, Y, and Z that might defend the prerogatives of some corporation. Michael, we'll have to have you back to talk about Peru and Colombia on Labor Radio. I certainly have been a frequent guest, and it's been a pleasure to have you on tonight. Mary Beth, did you have anything else you wanted to get out of Michael for his time this evening? I want to thank our listeners. We had, of course, plan to talk about some of the ballot measures. I think we don't really probably have time.
No, we can talk about that at the next show.
The 7th of July is, and you know, next week is actually the deadline. So we'll probably come back and talk about what qualified rather than what's sort of making it to the finish line.
I would just say, if you see a petitioner with a health care ballot measure, sign it.
There are no bad ones out there?
No bad health care ones. Oh, Bill Sizemore's credit scoring thing, but I think he actually turned those signatures in. But
there you go. Well, that's about all the time we've got. I want to thank you again for listening to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I'm Don McIntosh, and I'm with Mary Beth Healy. I'd like to thank our engineer, Ben Levine, and our guests. And we hope that you'll tune in again the following Monday at 6 p.m. for Labor Radio with host Bill Zimmerman. We do, of course, want to have give proper gratitude to two more supporters of this show that, you know, help keep the show on the air.
This KBOO radio program has been made possible in part by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
With support from ironworkers, Shopman's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resist their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743.